Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Patrick Meaghan, a writer best known for his work on Family Guy and Titus, who was arrested and imprisoned earlier this month while participating in the Occupy LA protests at City Hall. He will tell us a story of his treatment at the hands of the LAPD that the mainstream press failed to report, and we will discuss the rough treatment those protesting the destruction of our economy get in contrast to the kid glove treatment of those who reap billions of profits while bringing economic ruination upon millions of their fellow citizens, who in turn bailed them out with taxpayer money that has rewarded Wall Street while Main Street languishes. Then we'll hear about the 10 Greediest Americans of 2011. Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, joins us to discuss his Hall of Shame list of America's greediest CEOs who get exorbitant paychecks and bonuses while laying off workers, cutting their benefits, squeezing their pay, and making them work longer for less. Then finally, we discuss the likelihood of the euro crisis resuming soon in the wake of a European summit that many analysts feel did not solve the problem but kicked the can down the road. Stephen Walt, a professor of international affairs at Harvard University, joins us to discuss the financial crisis that will not go away, and we'll also talk about his latest article at Foreign Policy, Five Potential Game Changers in International Diplomacy. Joining us now is Patrick Meaghan, a writer best known for his work on Family Guy and Titus. Earlier this month, while participating in the Occupy LA protest, he and others were arrested and imprisoned. He wrote about the experience at myoccupylaarrest.blogspot.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Meaghan.
Thank you very much.
And there you were at 1 a.m. A couple of weeks ago reading Thich Nhat Hanh's Being Peace.
I was.
And you were then grabbed by LAPD officers. Weapons drawn, is that right?
Well, they had had their nightsticks out, and several of them had their guns that sort of issue, I guess they would be sort of like sandbag bullets or what have you.
Oh, I see. And then of course, you were pried loose from the circle of linked arms. Meanwhile,
yeah,
the officers were trashing all of your tents and ripping
them. Right. Well, the trashing of the tents came first. Anybody who was asleep in a tent at that time was awakened to police officers ripping their tents open with knives and then them forcibly pulled out of the tents, and then their, personal possessions would then be yanked out of the tents and sort of scattered across the ground. There were several people I was in jail with who said, yeah, I thought I was having a nightmare because I was asleep, and next thing I knew, my tent's being ripped open and people in riot gear are yanking me out of there. And this all preceded the arrests of the group of folks I was with, sort of around, sitting Indian style, peacefully and nonviolently around a tent, which is sort of the kind of like icon of the movement. Like I said, they pulled people out of the private tents, and then any sort of collective tents like the food tent or the health and wellness tent, for example, where they had been up until that moment treating anybody who needed free medical care, whether they were Occupy LA, activists or homeless people or, even a member of the LAPD, if they had wanted it, could receive free medical care at that tent. The LAPD commenced to just rip that to shreds and break the poles over their knees and let that scattered around. And what the mainstream media afterwards referred to as 30 tons of garbage, abandoned by the Occupy LA protesters was that. It was those objects, including my Thich Nhat Hanh book, taken from our hands and thrown across the park and left for maintenance workers to come afterwards and clean up while we were, marched away.
Well, Patrick Meaghan, one of the reasons why your blog took off so much and went viral was that, frankly, the press weren't there. They'd agreed, I take it, the mainstream media, to be corralled, and nobody was witnessing what was happening, right?
Well, that's exactly right. The LAPD announced ahead of time that only certain, hand-selected LAPD selected media outlets would be allowed to be present when they actually made the arrests. Every other media member who happened to be there was forcibly removed from the camp before any of the arrests took place. And so obviously the media members who remained were, essentially embedded media members. They were, they were beholden to the LAPD for, from my point of view at least, being given a media scoop that that their competitors didn't have. And so then, if they see somebody thrown right onto his face with his hands being held behind his back onto the cement, as happened to me, you know, if a media member saw that, he or she then had a choice between reporting that and making the LAPD look bad or going forward with whitewash, maybe is too strong of a term, but allowing the LAPD to continue to sort of massage the media in the way that they did. Also, my understanding is that those who were selected had to agree ahead of time not to reveal certain what the LAPD, I guess, called tactical methods that the LAPD used. So one of those tactical methods that I never saw reported in any sort of mainstream media was how they actually got the protesters to unlink. Of course, elsewhere and other such nonviolent protests, things like pepper spray have been used, and apparently that, you know, was considered to be too sort of like photogenic, and sort of viscerally horrifying, you know, a technique. So what they did with us, to anybody who refused to unlink, you know, while sitting there Indian style, is they forcibly pulled people's feet out, you know, extended their feet, and then would grab the protester's right foot and twist it all the way around until it was essentially sort of twisted backwards, and then sort of stomp a boot down on the insole of that bent backwards foot. And then they would take the protester's other foot, the left foot, and twist it all the way around the other direction and just keep twisting and twisting until the person, you know, just screaming in agony would let go of the protester to his or her right or left. So that was what was done instead of pepper spray. And I guess presumably pepper spray is supposed to be cruel and twisting people's feet in opposite directions is supposed to be humane and gentle. I don't know. But I didn't see that reported in any of the mainstream media, but I saw it with my own eyes, and it was terrifying. And, I mean, to me, it looked designed to terrify, and it worked on me. When they came to me, I decided I didn't want that sort of medieval torture treatment. I said that I would go peacefully and cooperatively.
But apparently that didn't do you any good because you were slammed to the ground and they stomped on your face.
You know, that's a mystery that maybe I'll take to my grave, not fully understanding. But I stood up and in fact, attempted to stand up at first just on my own to make their job as easy as possible, and was told, no, stay to your seat and, you know, on your bottom, and we'll lift you up when we're ready for you. And I said, okay, you make the call. You do whatever it is that you want. So they said, okay, we'd like you to scoot forward 3 feet on your bottom, which I did. And they kind of came in behind me and said, all right, on count of three, we're going to stand you up, which also then did happen. And I stood up and I moved my hands behind my back to accept the cuffs because, of course, I knew I was under arrest. And the police officer, for whatever reason, just grabbed my wrists and hyperextended them very quickly and rapidly and violently, wrenching my fingers down towards my forearms and sort of wrenching my wrists as far up towards my neck as it would go. I don't know what the intent was, but it hurt an incredibly huge amount, and I sort of involuntarily leaned away from, you know, what was occurring just because of the pain, and suddenly heard the police officer behind me yell, "He's resisting!" And that is when he then threw me face down into the pavement. And again, because my hands were being held behind my back, I had nothing to catch myself with, so I just landed right on my face, and the officer, you know, then dropped down with his knee right on the small of my back and started grounding my face into the pavement, yelling, he's resisting, as I was, you know, yelling, I'm not resisting, I swear to God, I'll do whatever you want. It hurts so bad, I'll do whatever you want, basically begging for mercy. And, you know, then they cuffed me, and that was sort of what it was like to be removed from that tent and cuffed.
Again, I'm speaking with Patrick Meegan, who's a writer best known for his work on Family Guy and Titus. Earlier this month, while participating in the Occupy LA protests, he and others were arrested and imprisoned, and he wrote about his experience at myoccupyLAarrest.blogspot.com. And then your zip cuffs were apparently so tight on you that you suffered nerve damage. Do you still have that nerve damage?
I do. Now, I should say, if you have to have any nerve damage in your hand, this is the one you want. I have full range of motion. It's just like this sort of tingling numbness, as if, if you've been Novocained, and then, you know, 4 hours later, your cheek still feels numb. Mm-hmm. It's like that. I mean, of course, now we're going on 10, 11 days later, but it's kind of like if I sat my hand down on a hot stove, you know, I wouldn't feel it, I suppose. But the doctor says it's the sort of thing that almost always heals itself within a few months. So it's again, if I had a choice of any sort of nerve damage in my hand to have, this is what I would want.
Well, I think Thich Nhat Hanh has gotten to you.
It's possible, I suppose.
Tell me about that. What happened, though, when after this, when you were all taken to the parking garage at Parker Center?
We were taken to the parking garage at Parker Center, and we were kept there on that parking garage. We were told to kneel. We all, of course, still had our hands cuffed behind our backs, because I guess, you know, we, as nonviolent seated protesters, we were considered to be incredibly dangerous. And it was about 7 hours there. We were initially told to kneel. As time went on, some of us were unable to maintain that kneeling position, so some of us sort of swung our seats out and kind of were on the side of our bottoms, or, you know, put our legs out. And the LAPD officers who were there didn't stop us from doing that, so I am grateful about that. But there were at least some of the protesters who were unable to sort of handle what was occurring, and one of the protesters crawled his way over to a garbage can and started just vomiting in it. He was very visibly ill, and then he was unable to hold himself up to that can anymore and sort of went down to the pavement and on his side and just started vomiting, and the police officers just sort of watched as he essentially vomited out and then passed out, and really at no point attended to him. But yeah, so that was our time for about 7 hours, and then around 9 a.m. we were finally put into cells and booked, and the charge was failing to disperse, which is a misdemeanor. And of course, for most misdemeanors, they don't, you know, if you roll through a stop sign, for example, that's a misdemeanor. It's relatively rare that if that happens to you, that the police officer smashes your vehicle, considers it therefore abandoned and has it destroyed by, you know, a maintenance crew, and then takes you off to jail and books you and puts you in a cell. But, you know, that's what happened to us. So we were considered to be, a sufficient hazard that we had to actually go in prison. But a $5,000 bail was set for us, and I was fortunate enough to be able to pay that that bail, but I quickly learned from my bail bondsman that although they set a $5,000 bail for us, the LAPD was then refusing to actually, or maybe a city attorney, I'm not sure, was refusing to actually accept that $5,000 bail, ostensibly because they were just so overwhelmed with the crush of us. So I asked, oh, because of this overwhelmingness, are they refusing to accept bail, you know, from any other person who's taken into LAPD custody today? So, nope, just you Occupy LA folks. So for the rest of that day, long into the night, if you were somebody who the LAPD picked up for murder or rape or something, if you qualified for bail, they would promptly and swiftly process that bail and send you on your way to streets of Los Angeles to do whatever it is you would then do. But if you had been caught sitting Indian style in the park after the police said not to, apparently you were considered enough of a danger that it was, you know, the city considered it worth its time and our tax money to house us in jail long into the night. And so that's where I was until about 2:30 a.m. the next morning, after about 25 hours. They finally started in just dribs and drabs, ones and twos, accepting the bail money that they had, again, set 15, 17 hours earlier. They finally took my bail. And so I got to walk out of there around 2:30 in the morning. There were another 200 Occupy LA protesters who were not as lucky, couldn't afford the bail, and so they, in the city's infinite wisdom, decided to hold them for another two full days, which my understanding is that's the legal maximum the city can hold a human being on a misdemeanor charge before actually releasing him or her. So, and among those 200 people who, you know, were such a danger to society, they had to be held for those two full days, was a 79-year-old great-grandmother named Ruth Sarnoff, who was about seven over from me in the circle. I guess the city felt like it was worth our collective money to make sure that 79-year-old great-grandmothers are kept away from the more vulnerable of us out there on the streets.
Sir Patrick Meaghan, again, writer best known for his work on Family Guy and Titus, he was participating in the Occupy LA protest and was arrested and imprisoned along with others. And he wrote about his experience at myoccupyLAarrest.blogspot.com. Is this particular animus on the part of the LAPD, or is this business as usual? Because my impression was that the mayor and the council basically ordered the police to lay off for quite some time. And I have been down there and did a program from down there and talked to a lot of people down there. And in fact, some of them said that they had problems from street people and Crips and Bloods and others coming in and people grabbing their food, etc. So it seems like there was a long period of hands off. And is it possible that the police were just sort of frustrated and now they had their opportunity to vent?
Yeah, I suppose that's entirely possible. This is the first I had heard about Crips and Bloods. My church had gone down each Sunday for the last few weeks before the camp was shut down to deliver or to distribute sandwiches, and I'm sure some of the folks who got those sandwiches were probably homeless people, but from my church's point of view, that's good. That's a good thing.
Right.
It's entirely possible that the LAPD officers felt like, you know, they had some frustrations to take out. It's entirely possible that everything I just described, in fact, you know, if asked to, I would bet money that everything I just described is what is experienced by people who are arrested by the LAPD every single day, and I just only know about what happens to me, and what happens to me is what happened to me. And the honest truth is, like, I'm actually not all that angry about what happened to me, insofar as I volunteered to be arrested, and it was the choice that I made, and I willingly, you know, sort of accept sort of with my body what it is that the LAPD sort of had in store for me, and it wasn't fun. And if I could write down what my ideal 25 hours would be, it definitely would not have been that experience. But, I accepted that experience. My point of view in taking that experience is just sort of to draw, you know, what I consider to be, you know, the contrast between what happens to, you know, if you wish, lawbreakers like myself who sit in a park after the police say not to, and much more powerful, much more consequential lawbreakers who, you know, have participated in just sort of coordinated and extended acts of larceny that drained hundreds of billions of dollars into their coffers and drained trillions of dollars from our collective economy and really have ripped the social fabric of our country for, you know, the past 4 years and perhaps for a generation beyond. The people who have defrauded our nation in the fiscal sector are sort of spared the zip cuffs, and they're not thrown face first into the pavement. And I think that that's wrong. And so I'm not upset that I got arrested, and I'm not upset about what happened to me when I was arrested and jailed. I just wish that I had the good company of the folks I consider to be some of the real criminals.
Again, I've been speaking with Patrick Meighan, a writer best known for his work on Family Guy and Titus. Earlier this month, while participating in the Occupy Los Angeles protest, he and others were arrested and imprisoned. He wrote about the experience at myoccupyLAarrest.blogspot.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the 10 greediest Americans of 2011. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran Labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article out on otherwords.org is The 10 Greediest Americans of 2011. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you.
And the 12 greediest Americans that you've found, I'm sure there's an awful lot of candidates out there.
Well, I mean, that's the real problem here. This list is somewhat arbitrary because there are hundreds of people we could have chosen. We could have looked at the list of hedge fund managers, for instance, top 10 of the top 10 earners in 2011. Last year, they averaged $1.75 billion each, all 10 of them made over $440 million. So you could make a case for just the top 10 hedge fund kingpins as the 10 most greedy. But what we tried to do was take a broader view and make the case that you don't have to be have a billion-dollar income to make the list of top 10 greedy. You do have to be insensitive and ruthless, and I think everybody on our list is.
Well, particularly starting out with number 10, the head of the CEO of Walmart, Michael Duke, who takes home $18.7 million, but he cut what was called premium pay, which meant for work.
That's right. Walmart workers for years and years got extra pay if they had to work hours on Sunday. CEO Michael Duke eliminated that premium pay for Sunday labor, and he also ended the Walmart profit-sharing plan with workers.
And and reduced their health care benefits and cut staffing levels so low that, according to Retailing Today, there are no employees left to round up the shopping carts in the parking lot.
That's right. And for all that, Michael Duke took home $18.7 million.
So just to, though, Sam Pizzicati, just to relate it to what you said a minute ago about the hedge fund managers not being on the list, I would think that there is a difference here in as much as although Walmart are screwing their employees, they do hire a lot of people. And we know about the jobs mantra that's out there, and particularly in this election year, we'll hear nothing but it. Hedge fund managers don't create jobs, do they? They just extract wealth.
That's exactly right.
I mean, they probably have.
You're making a very good case for putting them all on this this list, and certainly I couldn't argue against anybody who did that.
Right. Well, I just was thinking, you know, they probably only got a secretary and a few analysts, and that's it. You know.
That's right, and much of what they do, much of the wheeling and dealing they do, involves some stripping companies, laying off workers, and then breaking apart the pieces and selling them off for profit.
Well, let's talk about number eight Robert Iger, the CEO of Disney, since we're here in Hollywood. I guess Michael Eisner set the example, right? I think that guy took home over $1 billion while he was...
Yes, and in 1 year he set a CEO record with over $500 million.
Right.
So against that yardstick, Robert Iger looks kind of modest. But we need to look beyond that modesty and see that this past year he was pressing hotel housekeepers at Disneyland to pay more. A year more for the health care at the same time that he was pocketing $28 million for his labors.
And in your work, Sam Pizzicati, again, you're a veteran labor journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and we're talking about your article out at otherwords.org, The 10 Greediest Americans of 2011. In your work, And of course the division in wealth, the disparity in wealth is in the U.S. is one of the greatest. I think only Israel is probably, I suppose, Saudi Arabia, but nobody knows what goes on there. But it's way up there.
Yeah.
And what drives this? And they, of course, anybody that criticizes this are called the indulging in class warfare. But the truth of the matter is, there is a kind of class warfare out there that's been imposed upon everybody, and they've accepted this idea that somehow these corporate people are incredibly valuable. They see themselves as being incredibly valuable, even though they go from, you know, from a company that builds nuclear submarines to a company that builds bicycles. They have some peculiar talent that I find quite amorphous, but... What is it about the psychology of these people? Why do they feel, you know, because in Japan and other countries and in Europe, the ratio between the CEOs and the workers is nothing like it is here.
That's right. And indeed, I think the is that the situation today in the United States is very, very different from the situation 50 years ago in the United States. In 1966, Walt Disney, the actual Walt Disney, when he ran the Disney Empire, he made 108 times more what the housekeepers at the Disney hotels were making, 108 times more. Bob Iger now makes 781 times as much as his housekeepers. And if you look at it, if you look at the situation, I think there are two major factors that explain the difference. And those two factors are institutional. Back 50 years ago, we had a very steep progressive income tax in the United States. Until 1964, income over $400,000 faced a 91% tax rate. Now the comparable tax rate for that figure is 35%. And then also back 50 years ago, we had a very strong labor movement in the United States. We had almost a third workforce carrying union cards. Today, that figure is 7%. If you look at those two institutional factors, I think that explains a great deal of why CEOs are now making close to 800 times, in Bob Iger's case, more than their workers, instead of 100 times as they were years ago.
Well, Sam Pizzagatti, the New York Times has been doing some good reporting recently. They had a front page story on how corporate America is sitting on tons and tons of cash. And what they're doing is, instead of investing in R&D and plant and equipment, they're buying back their stock, their company stock, which then reduces the amount that's out there, raises the price, and makes the CEOs look good so that they can then in turn claim these huge bonuses, and at the expense of laying off more and more workers because they're not doing anything.
The term of art in corporate America for that is buyback, stock buybacks. And these stock buybacks may be the ultimate expression of corporate executive arrogance.
And again, it's all acceptable somehow that we have created this super race of extremely valuable people that require these enormous riches compared to the people who do so much of the actual work on the shop floor. I'm absolutely mystified at the kind of moral and social aspects of this that are inexplicable.
Well, it's a very closed fraternity at the upper echelons of corporate America. The boards of directors of Fortune 500 companies are primarily composed of CEOs, either active or retired, from other Fortune 500 companies. So it's a tremendous party of back scratching that goes on year after year after year at the top of corporate America in our CEO executive suites. We really need to end it, and there are a number of ideas that are floating around of how we can begin to turn the situation around.
Well, number five on your list, of course, is Lloyd Blankfein, Sam Pizzagatti, the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Just before the meltdown, he took home a record, I believe, $68 million in bonuses.
Yes.
And but now his pay is $19 million and rising, and he was a big player in the subprime meltdown. And one of the things I find so disgraceful about this situation is that you have millions of people who are aspiring to join the middle class, the very middle class that you were talking about a minute ago. They were victims of this fraud that the Wall Street has played on them, and they've been kicked out of their homes. So you have this really disgraceful situation where you have millions of homeless Americans' families, and you have millions of empty homes. And these people still could service a part of the mortgage, even though they were tricked into ridiculous mortgages. They could still service some of the bank debt, and yet they're not allowed to. What's the explanation for that?
Well, I think the explanation of that is sheer economic power translating into sheer political power. The bankers like Blankfein and his colleagues, his fellow plutocrats, have essentially been able to insulate themselves from investigation. There has been no major investigation of what's gone on in Congress. There's been nothing comparable to the Pecora Commission of 1933, which exposed the Wall Street fraud that helped lead to the 1929 crash. Nothing like that at all. There's been nothing like what happened after the savings and loan crisis. In the early 1980s. At that time, federal regulators turned over to the Justice Department for prosecution hundreds and hundreds of cases of banker fraud. So far, the regulatory agencies have turned over zero cases to the Justice Department for prosecution. The only explanation for that is that essentially the wrongdoers have been able to buy themselves protection.
So Sam Bitsakadi, again, a veteran labor journalist, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article out at otherwords.org is The 10 Greediest Americans of 2011. We're skipping around here a bit, but number three is Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle. He's collecting $77.6 million, he's already worth $35.9
billion? $39.5. He's the fifth richest individual in the world, and most of those near $40 billion have come from his holdings of Oracle stock. So the question becomes, what could he possibly need another $77.6 million for? That was his compensation for the 2011 fiscal year. Usually the rationale for these sky-high executive pay packages is that the executive needs an incentive to perform. Well, he's already got $39.5 billion. 77 adds less than 0.2% to his net worth. So what possible explanation could there be other than sheer avarice for arranging that sort of payoff?
Well, he doesn't show up to the office very much, does he? He's off sailing a lot of the time and playing tennis. I didn't think he was even an active CEO, but it does, we have the impression that the Silicon Valley people are a little less greedy than the Wall Street types, but I guess he goes against the grain there.
That's right.
Well, the one, though, that I find truly takes the cake in terms of being a disgraceful human being, and that's Don Blankenship, the former Massey Energy CEO, who's responsible, his greed and absolute disregard for workers, largely responsible for the 29 miners who died at the Upper Big Branch coal mine that he owned. He sort of wears American flag shirts and ties and blusters around as a true American. He pocketed $38.2 million from 2007 through 2009, and then $34 million in 2005, and he retired with a $5.7 million pension and $12 million in severance. And recently, a settlement was made over the deaths of these miners. The successor company that bought the mine from Blankenship paid out, I think, $300 million or something.
Right, which came to $1.5 million for each family, which was less than one third of what his retirement pension is.
And he so far he hasn't been touched.
Right, and it's unlikely that he will be touched. Most observers don't see a prosecution because there's no, quote, smoking gun linking him to it. But what he did, he created a management culture at Massey Coal, where the only thing that counted was increasing production, and you know, don't worry about the safety regulations. And in fact, the managers at Massey kept two sets of books. One set of books was a phony set of books that they showed when safety inspectors came around, and one was the actual set of books. He was the CEO. He was responsible for creating that culture, and he's going scot-free after 29 miners died.
So just in closing, the one that also gets at my outrage is Alan Mulally, the Ford Motor CEO, because the federal government bailed out Ford and General Motors. And after, you know, losing $30 billion over 3 years, he's been rewarded now $56.5 million in stock. And then a month later, he gets an additional $26.5 million. That was last year.
Yes, they announced that in the spring that he made $26.5 million for the most recent fiscal year, and then they've given him a $56.5 million stock, new stock award. And he's, Ford has returned to profitability, and it's essentially returned to profitability on the backs of its workers. In 2007, he forced a new concessions pact on Ford workers that reduced the entry wages to $14 an hour, essentially cut those wages in half.
So they're basically attrition. They get rid of the older workers who are expensive, and they bring in the new ones for pennies on the dollar.
Exactly.
And his salary amounts to 910 times the pay of the entry-level Ford workers.
Yes. Yes, and again, back in the 1950s, that differential, that ratio between top auto company CEO and average worker was less than 50 to 1.
And you and I and all the taxpayers listening are the ones that essentially rescued Ford.
Well, in Ford's case, the bailout was really not so much the factor as the sacrifices that workers made. GM Chrysler both got the hefty bailouts, and because they got those bailouts, for some period of time their executives were under some strings to keep the executive pay in check, but that executive pay over there has also increased over the recent past year.
Well, I stand corrected, but it still doesn't change the picture.
That's right. It's still an atrocious picture of pure avarice.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti. He's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article out at otherwords.org is The 10 Greediest Americans of 2011. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the euro crisis is far from over.
So excuse me, Mr. Butter. I'm a Mr. Two, and you're giving Mr. Bad name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, 'cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walter, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He is the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. His recent article at Foreign Policy is Five Potential Game Changers in International Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you.
And let's start with Europe. We were going to talk about that. And clearly, you've written also in Foreign Policy recently about kicking the euro down the road. My understanding is that this non-solution to this problem will result in the markets coming back sometime in January and to pound the euro again. Do you expect that to happen?
Yes, I'm afraid I do, and I'm not sure it'll take until January, because what European leaders were able to do last week is not something that's really going to solve the more fundamental problem. The central problem with Europe now is sort of a combination of a balance of payments problem between the southern zone countries like Italy and Greece, and of course a set of debts that they owe, which are of course held by banks throughout Europe and possibly elsewhere. And no one fully knows exactly how vulnerable those banks really are, because there may be sort of complicated derivatives and other financial instruments that would compound any kind of a run that would happen. The central problem, of course, is that that in order for the various countries in the south, like Italy, to sort of keep the banks happy, they have to be able to credibly promise to pay their various debts. And in order to pay their debts, they're going to have to grow economically. And what this deal is doing, of course, is enforcing greater austerity on these countries, which of course will choke economic growth. So eventually the markets will wake up to the fact that Italy, Greece, others are not likely to pay back the money, at which point they will start charging more interest for these countries to borrow more, and we'll be right back where we were, you know, a few weeks ago.
So, Stephen Walt, is there a better explanation for this 18 months of dithering? It's been suggested to me by some economists that there are elements in Germany and in the kind of elite amongst the European powers that would like to break the social democracy compacts, the social safety net, of course, which is infinitely greater than anything we have here in the United States, in order to make Europe more competitive with, say, Sri Lanka, which, of course, is the whole mantra of globalism, one that, of course, has resulted in the United States eviscerating its own industrial base. Do you think there is something else at play here?
Well, there are, in any society, there may be people who have an agenda like that. I don't think that's what's been driving this particular crisis. And if that's their objective, it will backfire horribly, because the only way you would do that is not just to dismantle the safety net, but you would ultimately have to put more and more people out of work, which is going to generate an enormous amount of social dislocation, probably strengthen not just, you know, free market right-wing parties, but more extreme right-wing parties, and you could really see a nightmare scenario down the road. I think this is much more of a sort of a classic case of people who may understand, you know, sort of what the long-term problem is, but can't see their way clear to solving it in the short term, because they understand that that would be painful. So what you've seen, I think, now for at least 18 months, maybe longer, is a set of half measures, people doing just enough to, you know, calm things for a while, even though they suspect things may get worse overall. There is, I think, you know, sort of one scenario here where this works out, and basically that at some point the Germans, who have been driving most of the responses, are satisfied that they have imposed enough discipline on the recalcitrant countries in the south, and at that point they will quietly signal to the European Central Bank that they should really intervene more readily to safeguard these various debts. You know, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, will at that point be able to go to her people and say, look, we've imposed enough order, we're going to get those Greeks to act a little bit more like Germans, and this will be politically saleable. That might work, but it's not at all clear that the European Central Bank will ultimately do that, which again would put us in essentially back in the same soup that we've been in several times in the past 2 months, with a lot of vulnerable economies and a lot of economic uncertainty.
And I wish
I had more good news to share.
Well, let me remind the audience again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He has a recent article in Foreign Policy, Five Potential Game Changers in International Diplomacy, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But let me just finish up, if we can, on Europe. This clearly, if the Europeans don't get their act together and the euro crashes, and it could be soon, as you mentioned in the beginning, that will have a terrible impact on the global economy, on the U.S. economy, and which is not in great shape. And surely that will have political consequences.
I think there's no question about that. And I've said, as I've heard a number of other people say, that ironically, perhaps the one individual in the world who has the most effect on the 2012 U.S. presidential election is Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany. That if she is able to sort of get the Germans to commit to do more to try and keep the Eurozone afloat, then, you know, the U.S. economy is likely to continue to slowly improve, and that would obviously improve President Obama's chances for re-election. If, on the other hand, you get a real meltdown in Europe at some point in the next year, this will have negative consequences for the United States. We don't know how severe, but they'll certainly be noticeable. And economic troubles here at home in a presidential election year is usually not very good for the incumbent. So in a funny way, Obama's fate may be very much in Angela Merkel's hands.
So turning to your article now at Foreign Policy, Five Potential Game Changers in International Diplomacy, Stephen Walt, the examples that are out there to give the audience an idea of what we're talking about here are Nixon's opening to China, Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. On the negative side, Molotov, von Ribbentrop, Hitler, Stalin Pact are examples of what you're talking about. The ones that you're talking about, perhaps, yearning for, are one, the United States takes the military option off the table with Iran. Two, Hamas revises its charter. Three, the United States proposes reciprocal global nuclear arms reductions. Four, Israel accepts the Arab League peace plan. Five, China proposes multilateral negotiations and arbitration over the South China Seas. And, of course, there are others as well. But beginning with taking the nuclear option off the table, it does seem in many ways that we could drift into a war with Iran as we pull out of Iraq. The green zone and the consulate in Basra are very vulnerable if an Iranian militia is unleashed. We've seen displays of what appears to be irrational behavior on the part of the ruling elite with the sacking of the British embassy. The Saudis are quietly, and the Saudis and the Israelis are quietly urging the U.S. to strike Iran. So it could be, we talk about Merkel being in charge of Obama's fate in 2012. If something happens in Iran, the price of gasoline goes up to $10 a gallon, right?
Well, I'm not sure it goes that high, but it could have, at least for some period of time, some pretty sharp effects on the price of energy. I think the first point to note is that in some respects we're kind of already in a low-level undeclared war with Iran. A war may be too strong, but we are clearly engaged in various forms of covert action there, either the United States or Israel or both. We know that Iran shot down, or rather, we lost a reconnaissance drone. The Iranians claim to have shot it down last week, which again reveals that we've been sending reconnaissance drones over there to survey their nuclear facilities and perhaps some other things as well. There's clearly a lot going on between the two countries that's short of all-out warfare, and I don't think there's really anybody in the Obama administration who's serious about trying to go to sort of an all-out military action against Iran. the difficulty is when you have this kind of simmering low-level conflict, that sometimes things can start to spin out of control. Each side starts taking actions, thinking the other one is so resolved upon trying to change the status quo, and cooler heads do not prevail. The second problem, and this was what I was really alluding to in the post I wrote, well, as long as we're doing this, there's really no prospect of an improved U.S.-Iranian relationship. So what I was suggesting was, people think outside the box for a minute, and instead of constantly repeating this mantra that all options are on the table, what might happen if the Obama administration said, look, we're not going to use force against Iran. It's not that much of a threat to our interests. We would obviously respond if Iran did anything, if it attacked a U.S. ally or anything like that. But we're not going to try and solve this problem by bombing the place. We're rather going to rely on diplomacy. This would be a position the United States has not taken for over a decade, and it might begin, not quickly, but over time, begin to open things up a little bit. What I was suggesting throughout this is that there are a number of places where if actors were willing to be bold and creative and imaginative, some diplomatic situations that are currently frozen might loosen up and we might actually see some genuine progress.
So again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He has an article in Foreign Policy Now, Five Potential Game Changers in International Diplomacy. Number two, of course, is the Hamas revising its charter, getting rid of this disgusting anti-Semitic nonsense, the protocols of the Elders of Zion being a part of the DNA of their ridiculous charter. That would of course change things. The U.S. is proposing a reciprocal global nuclear arms reduction. Now that's an interesting one. Give me a shorthand version of that.
Well, I think, more and more people understand that the real risks out there are not the fact that the United States is going to be attacked by some country conventionally or with nuclear weapons, and that the real danger that nuclear weapons pose now is the possibility that, some terrorist group might get a hold of a nuclear weapon or get a hold of nuclear material. One of the ways we reduce that danger is by significantly reducing the number of nuclear weapons in the world. And the question is, what can the United States do without going to, say, complete and total disarmament to encourage the other nuclear powers to reduce their arsenals along with us? So I was suggesting, again, almost as a thought experiment, imagine the United States, which has thousands of nuclear weapons either on active service or in stockpiles, says, look, we'll reduce ours by the same percentage that everybody else does. So if all the other countries agree to reduce by 10%, we will too. And of course, that means we're removing far more weapons than others are because our arsenal is so much bigger. We could even say in advance that, look, we're not going to go to zero. We're going to keep a couple of hundred, which is all we really need to deter anyone, because just imagine the damage you could do with a couple of hundred nuclear weapons against any other country. So we could say, look, we're going to keep a minimum deterrent, but we're going to try to encourage everybody who has them to slowly reduce down, and we'll follow suit. And even if we couldn't get everyone to go along, this puts us, in a sense, on the side of the angels. It makes it clear that we're sort of reasonable on this front. The final point, of course, to make is that the United States is the world's strongest conventional military power. So a world in which nuclear weapons don't play as big a role and aren't seen as having enormous prestige is actually a world that's one more attuned to our overall interests as well. It'd be nice to see the United States take a bold position like this, although I have to admit I'm not going to hold my breath.
Well, I would advise you not to hold your breath on number four, which is Israel accepting the Arab League peace plan, which the Saudis offered back in 2002. Interestingly enough, recently the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, castigated Israeli governments for not accepting or not taking seriously the Arab League peace plan. What about China's multilateral negotiations and arbitration over the South China Sea?
Finally, you know, lots of countries in Asia and Southeast Asia are worried about what China's rise means. And the dispute over a variety of little islands in the South China Sea and over who actually controls the seabed and the economic zones adjacent to the various countries there has been one of the flashpoints where a number of countries are very worried that China wants to basically turn the South China Sea into something of a Chinese lake. Now, several countries, including the Philippines, have proposed that this go to international arbitration, and China has basically rejected that view. Up until now, they say they want to do this all on the basis of bilateral negotiations with each of the separate countries. But it occurred to me that, you know, a really far-sighted Chinese leader would actually want to go the other way. Say, look, we would like to do a multilateral negotiation of all the interested parties, and if that doesn't work, we're perfectly happy to submit it to international arbitration. There's actually an existing international body, the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea, and we, China, will abide by whatever decision they accept. It might end up with a somewhat less optimal distribution of sovereignty in the region from a Chinese point of view, but this would be a very powerful diplomatic signal to some of China's neighbors that they didn't have territorial ambitions, that their rising power was nothing to worry about, that American concerns about security in Asia were probably overblown. Again, I'd be somewhat surprised if China did this, but this is the kind of thing that if a country did it, it would be a real game changer. It would alter the way in which China's rise is being viewed by some of its neighbors.
Well, just in closing, one of the game changers that wasn't brought up is the idea of ending the Indo-Pakistani dispute over Kashmir, and of course there are broader issues about U.S.'s deteriorating relationship with Pakistan, which is clearly a big part of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and it seems to such a vexed relationship. I'd say that would be the great Gordian knot, wouldn't it?
That's certainly one of them. The general point I would make is that there are lots of disputes and conflicts around the world that get hardened because, not just because there are significant interests involved, but because people, in a sense, become convinced that there's really nowhere to break out of them and that one simply has to wait for the passage of time. And I guess I place more value in human creativity and courage, that there occasionally statesmen can see outside what the normal constraints are and have the courage to make a bold initiative, as, say, Sadat did in saying he was willing to go to Jerusalem for peace, or as Nixon did when he made the opening to China. And that, therefore, we ought to be looking at some of those problems and asking ourselves, is there a way to cut through this that involves some imagination and some courage that might open things up to new solutions? And I was hoping the rest of my readers would propose some ideas of their own, and who knows, maybe one of them might actually get adopted and pursued.
And how would they do that?
I'm sorry?
How would they propose
again, it? Once ideas start getting talked about, right, things that previously appeared to be impossible suddenly become conceivable. You can start thinking about it. People can start debating it. If readers want to propose it, they just go to my blog and hit the comments thread, and they can throw their proposals onto it, and we'll see if we can get a conversation started.
Well, give us the blog.
It's walt.foreignpolicy.com.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Pleasure talking with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He has an article out now at Foreign Policy, Five Potential Game Changers in International Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.